This programming is sponsored by the UH Health Family Care Center, offering primary care and behavioral health services on the University of Houston campus. Health insurance plans, including Medicare and Medicaid, accepted. New patient appointments and more at 832-UH-CARES.
This programming is sponsored by Linscomb Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at LinscombWealth.com.
Well, welcome to Party Politics, a podcast usually taped at our favorite hangout, but today we're coming to you live from Lone Star College in Tomball, Texas. I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston. Like Jay said, we usually get together and have a cup of coffee or sometimes something stronger, depending on the week, and talk about politics. This week, we're going to talk about politics, but in a broader way. We are going to talk about things that are sort of political inputs. The first is about civic engagement, and the second is about free speech, generally, but also free speech on campus. So let's get to it. First of all, obviously, one of the cornerstones of participation in this country is voting. And so many of you know that Texas ranks extremely low on this list. Everybody says everything is bigger in Texas. That is not true when it comes to voting. You've all seen the numbers, and no doubt, like me, you are embarrassed by this. We have turnout in primaries that end up being in the 30s. And if you include people who are registered to vote, it's potentially lower. If you include people who are eligible to vote, it's even lower than that. So we are in a extremely abysmal phase of turnout in Texas. If we get to 50% turnout in a presidential election, that's a good year. That's not a standard we want to meet. So one question we had is just, why is this the case that it's so low? What are the dynamics to it? And what are the real impacts to it?
Part of the reason, I think some of the factors are things like level of education. Texas has about 28% or 27% of the eligible potential voters have bachelor's degrees, which is below the national average. We also are extremely diverse, extremely large, but that's not a good excuse because when you compare us to Florida, when you compare us to New York, we're actually much, much worse. And I guess recently there's been some changes, obviously because it relates to voter ID, but we've pretty much stunk up the joint even before that, right? I mean, this is a historical problem in terms of being in the 50s during gubernatorial cycles. We're in, as you said, in the mid-30s. We're probably going to have about a 35% turnout in 2018. And those other election cycles during the odd years, we'll have municipal elections in some cases in Texas cities or constitutional amendments. We're talking about turnout numbers of around 10%.
Yeah. The other way it's important is that we elect in Texas our judges. Now, you all know this to be true. It is not unique to Texas, but that Texas is only one of a handful of states that has partisan elections for judges. Now, you probably, as well as me and even Jay to some degree, although Jay is affiliated with a lot of these attorneys and at least knows many of them, but...
Oh, I don't know any of the judges. I'm going to tell you right
He's
now.
He's lying to you, yeah. The closer you are to the judiciary, the more you know, but most people don't know all these judges. You were electing 10s, 20, 30 sometimes judges, depending on where you live, and the voter fall off from the top of the ticket to the bottom of the ticket is about one third. That means that people go and check off like voting for president, voting for governor, voting for Senate, right? Maybe some of the members of Congress, but after that, people don't know enough about those offices down below it to do it. So that's one way in which we are really kind of underselling our democracy in Texas. The system has a setup so we elect people to do this work for us, and we aren't doing our heavy lifting. We aren't doing our part.
Yeah, we elect more people here in Texas than any other state in the country. We have the longest ballot. Take out the initiatives and referendums you see in California, which are as long as my arm. But in terms of actually voting for people, we vote for more individual offices here than any other place in the country. And this is the last cycle coming up in 2018 where you're going to have the straight ticket ballot. So a good chunk of the votes, a lot of these down ballot races that Brandon mentioned, about 75% of them all come out of the straight ticket. On some of the judicial races, those numbers are as close to 90% of the vote. So every vote counts dramatically.
There have been dozens of races in Texas alone where the outcome has been decided by 100 or so votes. So I pulled a couple in Pasadena in 2014. The race was decided by 152 votes. In a House district in Grand Prairie, this is a competitive House district, it was decided by less than 100 votes. I work for a candidate who's a friend of mine in Dallas in 1999. That dates me, sorry. most of you were alive by then, I want to make that clear. In 1999, we lost that race by 400 votes. He ran again in 2015 and lost in a runoff by 186 votes. So literally, that's the number of people in this building, right? That's the number of people in your dorm, right? In your apartment complex. So you can make a difference in these kind of contexts because these local elections are really critical to how we govern and to the kind of decisions that they get made. Like, this is home level stuff, right? This is like, is your sidewalk going to get fixed, right? How often are they going to spray for mosquitoes in your neighborhood?
Right. And talking about local government, school board is a great example of that, where tiny, tiny turnouts can really sort of influence the outcomes of these races. HISD, Houston Independent School District, had a special election this past cycle where the winner, Ann Sung, won by fewer than 30 votes.
Wow.
And there was a recount as a result of that. You've got community college boards. The one that we're sitting in right now has an elected board. I don't know how many of you have ever voted for your community college trustee, but you can vote for your community college trustee. It's critically important because there's so few people voting, and who runs our government is determined by the people who actually vote. And so when we talk about sort of the turnout numbers, it's important for you guys to also think about this. We're talking about in the big picture. So when we say a third of the people vote in gubernatorial elections, about half vote in presidential elections, about 8%, 10% in these sort of special elections for cities and or constitutional amendments, if we take that number and we divide it out by demographics, is when we see an even bigger problem. And we understand to some extent why Texas looks the way it is, why the representatives look the way they do. Texas, as we said, about half the people vote in presidential elections. Okay, if you look at the state of Florida, 62 to 63% of their eligible voters. So what, though 12% differential, almost invariably are younger, they're more minority, and they're less traditional voters. When you scale that down to gubernatorial elections, you see that exact problem even magnified. So the average age in a gubernatorial election is what, about 55, 56 years old, right? And so that impacts who gets elected and what their issues are and what matters to them.
Yeah. Let's not let Florida beat us, right? Like, that's not
acceptable.
Yeah,
I know. All right? States, right? Florida.
Right. We need to rank a little higher, I think. Well, the kind of final question of our segment is, then, what can you do about it? I had a couple of suggestions, and I know Jay does, too. I think number one is obviously register to vote. You need to be able to be, like, suited up when it comes time for the election. That's basic stuff, right? I'm not even going to have to go into that. You have to be registered to be able to play. If you don't show up, you can't play. I think, too, that educating yourself about the votes is really critical. There are a lot of candidates, but there's a lot of information too. So knowing all the way down the ballot who these individuals are is critical. And part of that is not voting straight ticket. Jay said straight ticket voting as a way of voting is going away in a couple of years. That's definitely true. The legislature has done away with that. But it's going to be in effect for the next couple of cycles. So don't vote straight ticket. Learn about the candidates. Vote the person as opposed to the party. I think that's a big factor here. I also note this, and this is interesting. If you are inclined to vote for one party, the other, Republican, Democratic Party, then you can actually join to be a local precinct chair. These are people who are basically the architecture of government at the party level, at the very smallest level. But you have a lot of say in what the party does in terms of the county and then potentially at the state. Almost half of all of the precincts in Harris County do not have a precinct chair, Republicans and Democrats. So this is an easy way to be able to simply walk into the office of the party that you like, say, I want to be a precinct chair, and they will sign you in after a quick interview, and you can be part of that system. It's that easy, and that's local government at its best.
Yeah, the second half of you yourself getting out there voting and you yourself participating is getting your friends and your family and everyone you know to do the exact same thing. What you want to try to do is build a sort of a civic culture right, or ecosystem around you, of folks who are committed and wanting to vote and wanting to participate, because as we were talking about earlier, the numbers are so small. We've just got to get numbers up. We've got to get more people interested in voting. And I think for folks who are younger, it's even more important, because so many of the critical decisions affecting you, you just don't have a say in if you're not participating in the process. And so it's critically important to do that. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to tell you why this is important and find out what you want to talk about.
So we talk a little bit about one element of how people participate. Another way is through the bedrock of democratic foundation in this country, and that's freedom of speech. It's interesting because the history of free speech is so critical to the development of the U.S. That in the time of the revolution during colonial America, many of you may know this, and you probably learned this in some of your classes, like the pseudonyms that people would use would have to be hidden, and people would write newspaper articles under false names to be able to challenge the British government and the crown in England, because they feared, of course, if they were to make that public, that they would be killed, right? Literally hung for treason. So the importance of that free speech and fomenting the American Revolution was so important that they codified it into the document of the Constitution. This is why it's so important to the fabric of what we do, and it's clearly important here on a college campus. But that's something that is always in jeopardy. It is not a right which exists without our ability to kind of follow through with it, right? So let me ask you guys a question. How many of you are advocates of free speech? Raise your hand. Free speech is good. Okay, keep your hands up. If you think that free speech is unqualified, put your hands down. If you think that free speech can be limited if somebody says something bad about you or someone that you know, okay? Can free speech be limited if somebody says something offensive to minority groups? Okay, couple of hands go down. So it's interesting. Pew did some surveys that asked the question, what limits our free speech? And what they found was that 40% of people in your age group said that if it's the case that somebody says something offensive about some other group, especially a minority group, then they can have that free speech right taken away. For people in your grandparents' cohort, it was 12%. So free speech only exists in a moment in which we can really embrace it and keep it alive, right?
Right. And the other part of free speech is free expression. That's a big part of it. So that comes out in music, and that comes out in literature, and that comes out in everything
Facebook.
Else. Exactly. And that, that's really the current manifestation of free speech, right? And we were talking about this earlier, that social media plays such a critical role in this. And you've all heard sort of comments related to, you know, the idea of sort of things, something being fake news or real news, or et cetera, and how important social media is in general in that space. Part of the thing to remember is that your ability to do something, your ability to say something, while it may not be limited or governed, we're in a realm where now things are permanent. You can say something out there, and it will be out there for a very, very long time. But this balancing test we have, because traditionally the law has said with free speech that short of, you know, yelling fire in a movie theater, you have an absolute right to express yourself and state your position. The Supreme Court has argued that political expression in the form of contributions to candidates cannot be limited, and that is an expression of free speech, your ability to determine who you want to give money to. Advocating for a political candidate, the same way the court has ruled that that is a manifestation of this idea of free speech. So your ability to do it is pretty unqualified, short of putting someone else in danger. But then that's where it gets to be sort of a gray area. Texas A&M University, not too long ago, had stopped Richard Spencer, who is an alt-right neo-Nazi leader, from speaking there. What do you guys think? Is that something that should be done? Brandon, what are your thoughts? Should students have the ability to limit speech that they define as hateful?
I think not. You know, college campuses should serve as the wellspring of an educated mind, and limitations on that only create more problems, so that free speech is the most important to people who have the least power, the least access, the least voice. That's why free speech works. I wrote down a quote from Frederick Douglass, which I thought was really telling, and that is that power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. It sounds like he could have written that like yesterday, right? Because it's so profound. And without that free speech, it's hard to be able to challenge people politically. It's hard to be able to express yourself and really to learn, right? Part of what free speech means is listening. It's not just about speaking. And so to me, it's a bit of a two-way street. But on Jay's earlier point, you know, he mentioned that this is a right which is largely unqualified, but not invisible. And so I just made up a word,
invisible.
You are witnessing history right now, right? What we find is that on both sides of the picket line that you're going to be watched, right? The Constitution in Texas provides free speech. The U.S. Constitution provides for free speech. But you also, in doing that, are watched. What you say will be on the internet. The way that you do it, the pictures of it will also be on the internet. I'm reminded of one of these sort of alt-right, sort of white supremacist events that took place. People did some internet sleuthing and found out the names and locations right. of some of those people who are probably going to have a hard time getting a job, right? Now that you're like known to be, you know, marching with white supremacists. So just know that the rights that you are using are responsive to you, but you're also responsible to those rights. So keep in mind that it's a bit of a two-way street.
And the flip side of free speech, of course, is the ability to protest. And so how do you balance that? I know that if there's an issue that's front and center in the news, it's the whole idea of protesting right now, and it's all in the eye of the beholder.
I think free speech only works if it works for everyone. And part of free speech is about listening, like I said. To me, this is more than just politics. This isn't like just a class assignment. This isn't something that we read in a book that's dusty and, you know, we pull off the shelf. This is about relating to people, right? This is about literally talking to, like, your friends who you disagree with, right? It's about getting along with your crazy uncle, right? Knowing that people have different opinions than you and recognizing that you can meet them halfway as part of just living in a society, right? Knitting together that fabric. So it's more than just politics, I think. It's also about how to live in this world and how to maintain a kind of civil dialogue between people who are all, frankly, in the same boat.
Yeah, the respect element, I think, is the last thing we really want to talk about here. And it's the idea that you want to honor not just your right for free speech, but you want to honor someone else's right to speak. And almost especially when they don't agree with you. I mean, it's critically important, particularly in a college environment, I think, to listen to, especially to ideas that you wouldn't naturally gravitate towards. There's absolutely nothing wrong in that. That's part of the educational process. If you come from a household that's liberal, go out and listen to conservatives, hear what they have to say, try to understand what where they're coming from. If you grow up in a conservative household, do the exact opposite. Try to listen and understand what the ideas are of folks who are liberal. That's what college is about. That's what free speech is about. And that's what we talk about when we talk about the marketplace of ideas.
If you're a Cowboys fan, you know, watch the Texans occasionally, right?
Yeah. Yes.
a Texans fan?
But if you're a Texans
don't
fan,
watch the Cowboys.
Never watch the Cowboys.
Never.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to really find out what you guys think about all of this.
My name is Kevin. When you're discussing about the voter turnout earlier, do you think, like, gerrymandering, especially since in Texas, do you think that has a play in the fact that voter turnout has become so slow because, like you say, their voice may not be heard at all?
Yeah, most research suggests that, like, the gerrymandering does reduce voter turnout, in part because they have narrowed the number of people who could potentially win in a seat, right? In theory, competitive elections drive voters to come vote, so if it's a not competitive election, then people aren't going to come vote. But I think on the larger point that you make is that there are these structural factors that limit the ability or desire of people to go vote. So some states that have bigger turnout have like same-day voter registration, right, which Texas doesn't have. We have a limit, a window where you have to register before 60 days before the election. And so that's one factor that, you know, if done in a modest way, can really increase turnout. So the rules really do create low turnout. I don't know if it's on purpose or not, but it's certainly limiting people's ability to turn out.
Hi, I'm Virginia. I have a couple questions. I think I'll start since we're talking about party and talking about low voter turnout. I certainly agree with you that there is a responsibility that as citizens we bear in terms of, you know, get out there and vote. But also in terms of the parties, do you think that they have some sort of responsibility, particularly for those populations that feel like they're not heard?
Yeah, you know, Texas is traditionally a kind of weak party state, so the parties haven't been as adept as they are in other places at really wrangling voters and keeping people within the party line. So that's one thing that the parties haven't done terribly well historically in Texas. But I'll say, too, that absolutely it's the case that them reaching out is critical. The best way to get somebody to vote is to ask them, right? Yes, literally ask them. That is the best way to get people to vote. Like study after study shows this to be true. This is especially true for younger people and for racial and ethnic minorities. So if you want Texas, which is a young state and one which is much more diverse than it was, to vote, the parties have to do a better job communicating to those groups.
From the political perspective, the Republicans win a lot of elections in Texas, and there's no incentive for them to essentially change the deck chairs right now. On the Democratic side, they're just so poorly organized, both at the local level and at the statewide level, that the kind of direct voter contact they need to Brandon's point, there's a view, if you look at the polling data, the difference between registered voters' attitudes and likely voter attitudes is pretty significant. In fact, it's a much greater shift than almost any other large state. So if you look at New York or California or Florida, the people who are registered to vote and the people who are voting think pretty much about the same. Okay? Texas, the people who are likely to vote and the people who are registered to vote, there's a massive differential, about 15 to 20 points in some areas on everything from transportation to gun control to abortion rights. Part of that is because we have automatic registration, there's a lot of folks who are registered to vote but are never engaged. Political parties reach out to prior voters because the greatest predictor if you're going to vote is if you voted in the past. It may sound like I'm sort of picking on the Democrats more. It's just that they have much more to grow and they have a much better job to do to catch up. And that's why they're losing so much.
I want to thank you guys for coming and being out here in Tomball. How do you guys feel about online voting? Clark Friesen, I'm a speech professor here.
In terms of online voting, I'm in favor of it in principle. If we can figure out a way logistically to make it work, then let's do it. I think more realistically, perhaps, is just the process of getting everybody registered to vote online. That's one thing. And or having just people automatically registered to vote when you become like a Texas resident. So baby steps probably on that. But I think that technologically they can take that in pieces and probably improve things greatly with just a couple of small changes.
I'm a bigger fan of same-day registration. I'm not a fan of the registration process. The history behind voter registration is essentially designed to disenfranchise voters, make it harder to vote. So anything that makes things easier to vote, I think, is a positive. As far as sort of the marketplace of ideas, I think the flip side is that we talked about this earlier about respecting other points of view. I think where it gets very hard for a lot of people and a lot of students is just this idea of when is being respectful in another point of view having to be respectful of someone being offensive. And that's hard for them, particularly on a personal basis.
We talked about other forms of voting. Some local governments and states have adopted a system where you mail a ballot to the registered voters. Initial impressions on that, and also I took a question from someone else who wanted to pass it through me, is the idea, would you differentiate between free speech, and there's been a term that's started kicking around, the idea of weaponized dissent. Would you differentiate a little bit on that?
Yeah, I'll take the first question first.
And I'm Corey, by the way.
Yeah. Thank you again for hosting. I'll say that the percentage of mail ballot fraud is pretty low. It's higher than in-person fraud, but traditionally that has not been a real problem. There are some full states that have all mail-in ballots, and it traditionally hasn't been an issue if it's done properly. There are some counties in some states that do mail ballot. I will say just personally, it's a much easier to mail your ballot back in than it is to go stand in line and find your polling place and everything else. So just, I think, from a cost-saving sort of time-saving perspective, the way that we talk about voting, it's about cost, right? The cost of waiting in line, of being informed. The more we can reduce that cost, the better. So I'm all in favor of it.
Voting via mail has worked. I think Oregon has full state, vote by mail rather. And so that to me, I think, is a good model. In many ways, almost probably a superior model to online voting because you can, there are some checks and balances in the mail system that you don't have online. I would definitely be in favor of that. But again, I think it would require a change in sort of the political culture because there's no real incentive for people to get more people to vote.
On your second question, I'll just say that the governor of Florida issued a proclamation, a state of emergency, that Richard Spencer was going to give a talk at the University of Florida in that county. Ratcheting things up is worse than toning things down. Free speech means at least an interaction. It means an evaluation. It means attention to both sides, but it cannot mean weaponization, which sounds horribly violent to me, which is not what we want. That's the opposite of what we want.
That's it for our special episode of Party Politics at Lone Star College in Tomball, Texas. If you enjoyed what you heard today, subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter with the hashtag PartyPoliticsPod, or you can email us at PartyPoliticsPod@HoustonPublicMedia.org.
Thank you again so much to Lone Star College for hosting us, to Corey Colby for inviting us, to Jeffrey Pino and Jay Hargett for technical help, to Houston Public Media, our extraordinary producer, Adele Halland, our audio engineers, Todd Hooslander and Shannon Harrison, and finally to our incredible studio audience.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next week.